Our seven tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting. At this time, we will be passing the baskets. And we welcome everyone to please attend our business meeting, which is the last Monday of each month at 6:45 p.m. It's the last Monday of the month at 6:45 p.m. here at the church. The church requests that smokers please use the provided containers and not leave any cigarette butts on the ground or the parking lot. We also ask that the use of the church is limited to the bathrooms, which are located to the left or to the right in the back foyer. Please feel free to stay after the meeting for fellowship, and please turn off all cell phones. At this time, we ask that you limit your movement during the meeting, especially during the speaker's talk. And I've asked somebody to read the preamble, to come up and please read the preamble. I don't know who has what, though. It's Tyler.
Hey guys, I'm Brian. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey Brian.
This is the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. Thanks for letting me read.
Thanks for reading.
And I have asked a friend to read the 12 steps.
Tyler, alcoholic.
Hey, Tyler.
12 steps. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thanks, Tom.
Great. And lastly, I've asked a friend to come and read the set-aside prayer.
Thank you.
Hi, Regina.
Hello, Regina, alcoholic.
Hey, Regina.
The set-aside prayer. Dear God, please set aside anything I think I know about myself, about my illness, about the big book, the 12 steps, the program, the fellowship, the people in the fellowship, and all spiritual terms. Especially you, God, so that I might have an open mind and a new experience with all these things. Please help me to see the truth. Amen.
Amen.
Fantastic. All right. Well, please help us welcome our speaker tonight.
I'm Rory McShane. I'm alcoholic.
Hey, Rory.
Shutting off the lights here, okay. I'm sober since June the 5th of 2010. My home group is the Primary Purpose Group in Austin, Texas. I have a sponsor, Bob Darrell, who knows he is my sponsor. You could argue he's painfully aware he's my sponsor. And I sponsor a whole lot of guys. You know, it's funny, I've been getting asked to speak in Alcoholics Anonymous a lot recently. I've probably done, I don't know, maybe 8 or 10 talks over the last month or so. And I was sitting around with my sponsor and some other guys, and I was saying, you know, I've been asked to speak a lot recently. I was just speaking out in Las Vegas and speaking down in Texas and speaking on Zoom and speaking up here, and I'm speaking in DC tomorrow night. And I was like, I think maybe, you know, it's getting more spiritual or something, you know, I think. And Bob goes, my sponsor goes, I don't think that's it, Rory. I think Alcoholics Anonymous has been a little crowded recently, and they wanted to invite you to come kind of see if we could thin it out a little bit. And clearly it's worked, right? Clearly that has been successful here. So y'all did a great job getting the word out, you know. And oh my goodness. It's funny, man. I used to use notes and stuff when I talk sometimes. I really don't do that anymore. I kind of just try to ask God to help me be as honest and vulnerable as I can, right? It's very rare, if ever, that I've had a guy come ask me to sponsor him because he heard some wonderful big book wisdom that I share, right? Well, if you look on page 63 at this line, it says the same thing as page 22, and like, you know. But when I've shared real and genuine and painful things that I've been through and gotten sober through, it's helped some people, and that's what helped me and gave me the willingness and desire to be sober and willingness to take the actions here in Alcoholics Anonymous. So that's what I'm going to try and do as well as I can tonight. I when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I absolutely understood on some level, the first part of the first step. And what the first part of the first step tells me is it tells me that once I start drinking, I cannot stop, right? And I had a lot of evidence of that. I grew up down in Maryland, right? And I live out in Texas now. And Maryland's a small state, right? And all the states on the East Coast are pretty small. Like, it was not super uncommon that, like, start drinking in Maryland and wake up in Pennsylvania or wake up in Virginia or Delaware. Like, that was a relatively common experience. You start drinking and go on a runner in Texas, and, you know, you can drive all night and still be in Texas the next morning, right? So you don't get that, like, what the hell am I doing in another state, you know? You don't get those moments. But I could have, my first day in Alcoholics Anonymous, I could have given you plenty of examples of when I started and could not stop, right? It's funny, the longer you stay sober, you sometimes remember things that you'd forgotten, and people will tell you stories about you, right? There's nothing worse than other people having a lot more information about your own life than you do. One time I was, we were just down in Maryland yesterday, and I remember this time that I was at this party with a buddy of mine, and we're drinking and we're doing some outside issues, and that means drugs for the new people. So we're drinking and we're doing some drugs and we go to leave the party, and I'm in the passenger seat of this van, and we go to turn on the Governor Ritchie Highway, and I open the door of the van because I have to vomit, right? And I start to vomit, but I can't physically hold myself up at this point. So I fall face first out of the van into my own puke on the freaking highway, right? And it didn't bother me at all. Like, it was nice and cool on a hot day and, you know, everything, right? And my buddy leans over, he's like, you can't just take a nap on the highway, Rory, like, you know. So he, like, comes and he gets me up into the van and we get over to his house, and I clean myself off and everything. And I go ask him, like, Chris, what do you got to drink here? And he's like, are you kidding me? You were passed out on the highway 45 minutes ago. Chris, you clearly didn't hear my question. What do you have to drink? That doesn't relate to whether I was passed out on the highway. Can you stay on topic for me, please, right? But to him, that's insane. But to me, that's perfectly normal, because once I stop, I have an allergic reaction, which causes me to want more. I can't stop. My brain doesn't process alcohol the way other people's does, right? If we all went out to eat after the meeting and I ordered a peanut butter sandwich and I had an allergic reaction to that peanut butter sandwich and my throat swelled up and I couldn't breathe and y'all had to rush me down to the hospital, y'all have hospitals around here, right? It's not like some Amish guy in a beard with, like, you know, right? Yes, maybe? Okay, I hope so. And you guys had to rush me off to the hospital after having this peanut butter sandwich. You'd say, wow, Rory has a pretty serious allergy to peanut butter. But if y'all came to check on me tomorrow and I was sitting there eating another peanut butter sandwich, you wouldn't think my biggest problem is peanut butter anymore. You'd think this guy's insane. You know what people who have an allergy to peanut butter do?
They don't eat peanut butter. They don't go to Peanut Butter Anonymous. They don't get a peanut butter sponsor, and they don't work the peanut butter steps, right? In our book, it says the biggest problem of the alcoholic is centered in his mind, not in his body. Because every time I make that decision to drink again, every time I make that decision to drink again, I make that decision sober. And in light of my experience, that's the most insane decision I can make. And I didn't understand that when I got here. What I understood is that once I started, I didn't ever seem to be able to stop, right? Because if I say I'm going to go out and have two beers, right around one and a half beers, tonight's a bad night for two, right? Like, tonight's a way better night for four. But right around three and a half, four was the wrong number. Tonight's a good night for six. And after six, it's like, screw it, we're on, right? I was thinking about this time. It was a summer day, right? It's a real nice day outside, and it's me and my girlfriend and my buddy and his girlfriend, and we're gonna grill some hamburgers and have some potato salad and have a real nice kind of summer day. And we go and we pick up a 12 pack of beer for me and him, and we pick up a six pack of those hard lemonades for the girls. I don't know if they still make those anymore. You know what I'm talking about? Those hard lemonade deals. And so he has a couple of the beers, and I drink the rest of them, of course, right? And, somewhere around eight or nine beers, we're off and running, right? And I go in the fridge, and I go to start drinking these hard lemonades. And my sweet little girlfriend at the time comes up, and she's like, but you bought those for me and my friend. So I was like, and I, like, scream at her, and I'm like, I pay the bills in this house. I'll drink whatever I want to, right? It is important to mention to you that at this point I was unemployed and we were living with my mother. I've never found that particularly important to mention. Various sponsors I've had over the years have thought that was important to mention. Because once I start, I can't stop, right? And I can start to see that there's something different happening to me than the kids I'm going to high school with, right? When we all go out and start drinking on Friday nights, these kids are doing weird stuff like showing up for class on Monday, right? And that didn't compute for me. I wasn't particularly interested in that equation. But at a certain point, I start to notice that my life is going a very, very different direction than I'd wanted it to go, right? When I was 14 years old, I was into Boy Scouts, and I was on the football team, and I was in Harvard Model Congress, right? I wanted to go to West Point, be an officer in the Army. I was a straight arrow kid. And a couple of years later, I'm kicked out of a school in a parent's house, and I've been arrested at this point. I'm the guy that the school cop is looking for, and I've been thrown out of my second parent's house, I'm staying on your couch until your parents find out I'm there. And I was a hobosexual for a while. I'd fall in love for a place to live, and I was young and good looking back then. I'm fat and bald now. I can't pull that off. And this girl comes to me that I'm seeing, and she says, I'm pregnant, right? There's a couple guys in the room who know me a little bit and have heard me speak before. That's a repetitive theme through my story. I have a second career as a distributor of young Irish Catholics, right? That's been my secondary job. That means I've had a lot of kids, for those of you who So this girl comes to me and she says I'm pregnant, and I'm not a sociopath, man. And very few of us, sponsored a couple hundred guys over the years, very few of us are, right? We don't want to ruin our kids' lives. We don't want to break mom's heart. We don't want to get fired from that job, right? We really want to give it our best shot, man. And I tell this girl, I say, look, I promise you, I'm gonna straighten out. I'm gonna straighten out my act, and we're gonna have this baby, and we're gonna do this together. And I promise you. And her father had said, Rory, if you can straighten out your act, I'm gonna get you a job at the construction company I work at and get you a little income going. And I go back to my father and I say, Dad, if you will let me move back in the house, I'm gonna finish high school, I'm gonna work this job. I swear to God, Dad, I swear that I will stop getting loaded. I will stop, I promise you, right? And had you hooked me up to a lie detector test, I would have passed that lie detector test because I honestly, honestly wanted to stop, right? But what I didn't know at that time was that I might as well have promised that man that I was going to sprout wings and I was going to fly around the house and I was going to come back and land, because I didn't have the ability to make that promise. And there is a solution in our book. It tells us every alcoholic reaches a point in which the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. That relationship isn't going to get me to stop drinking. That those kids aren't going to get me to stop drinking. That great job isn't going to get me to stop drinking. If you suffer from what I suffer from, if you're what our book calls the real alcoholic. I used to run with this guy named Dan Sinky Boy. And to look at us both on the outside, we looked exactly like each other, right? We were, we both drank as much as each other, and we used like each other, and we both thought we were little gangsters, and, you know, we had this little cigarette running operation for a while, and all this stuff, right? And I mean, I loved this guy. I mean, the first time I got out of treatment, I went to treatment for the first time when I was 16 years old, and I did the most important thing you can do in your first treatment center. I got a treatment center girlfriend, and, God damn, man, she had those socks with the little grippy feet on them, and I was, that's a Cinderella slipper if I've ever seen one. Oh, my God. And we got a treatment center girlfriend, and we got out of there. I didn't stay sober. Most of you could have guessed that after that. So what was I going to say? I got a little ADD working up here, so sometimes we'll go off in one direction, and I'm always real surprised if we get back on track, and no one's prouder than me if we do that. So Sink, right, he comes to me one day. So I love this guy, right? This guy, literally, I get out of my first treatment center at 16 years old, and I'm back at my mother's house, right, because that's where all good gangsters end up, right? That's the end of the road for all of us. And he's, like, knocking on the basement window my first night out of treatment, and he's got a 30 rack of natural light beer, and I'm like, my guy, right? That kind of friend, right? So he comes to me one day, and he says, look, man, I'm not going to do this crap anymore. I met this girl, Megan, and we're in love, and we're gonna get married, and we're gonna have some babies. We're gonna move to New Jersey, and I want to be an EMT fireman. I'm gonna get a good job, and I still don't know who the hell moves to New Jersey to get sober, but it worked. But he was able, given sufficient reason, right on page 21 in our book, given sufficient reason, he was able to stop drinking. He met the girl, he changed his environment, they had some kids, I was in their wedding, it was a beautiful wedding, and he was able to stop. And what I didn't understand is why he could stop when he swore he was going to stop, why he could stop and I couldn't. Because both of us, if we'd gone and seen an alcohol addiction counselor and a drug addiction counselor, that counselor would have labeled us both alcoholic. But as it goes in our literature, he isn't. He's what we call the hard drinker. Right? His problems stop once he puts down the drink. My problems are just getting started. And that's what I didn't understand at that time. So this girl's pregnant, and I swear to God, I'm going to stop. And I meant it with every fiber I had, every fiber of my being. And I'm just, right? I felt like I was holding my breath. And at a certain point, you always have to breathe again. Right? So I'm holding my breath, and I make it 6 weeks, and I come to in a motel bathroom in Hagerstown, Maryland, right? And I tried a couple other times after. Unfortunately, she lost that baby in a miscarriage, and her parents basically said, you know, if we ever see you around here again, we're calling the police. And I didn't begrudge that at all. And I tried a couple other times after that to stop, right? Because I know something's going wrong. I did this young lady I went to high school with had invited me to come to her church. She knew I was really struggling. I went down to this church, and I went to the Bible studies and the church groups . And these wonderful people, they shared with me about the God of their understanding and how if I just believe in this God of their understanding that I could stop. And I really, really wanted to, man. I was jumping for Jesus, man. I wanted it to work so badly I even broke up with my punk rock girlfriend, right? Like, you know, that's a level of willingness right there. So I want to believe. So fast forward a little bit, June the 4th of 2010, you know, I'm back living at mom's, right? It's a kind of constant theme. I'm proud to say that I have not moved back in with my mother since I've been sober. If it never gets better than this, that's a good accomplishment right there, right? So I'm living at mom's and I get loaded and I get violent. It's not the most loaded I've ever been, and it's not the most violent I've ever been. Right, but this poor woman, 4'11" woman, 105 pounds, soaking wet. This woman had paid for defense attorneys and treatment centers and doctors and psychiatrists and psychologists and anybody who told her that they could fix her kid that had a couple of letters after their name. Anybody with a certificate on the wall who said I can fix your kid, she'd hand her credit card to. Right. So this wonderful woman tells me I've got 2 hours to get out of her house, or she's calling the police and she's having me trespassed on her property. So I start calling this guy, he's like an addiction counselor kind of guy that I'd had to go see every time I'd kind of get in trouble, and I start calling him, I'm ringing his phone off the hook, and he finally calls me back. He says, look, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been sober. He says, I'm not working today, but I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been sober for 12 years, I think it was at the time. And there's a meeting over in Brooklyn, Maryland, and why don't you go to it? That's South Baltimore. If you ever find yourself there, I suggest you get out quickly, but anyways. So if you know where it is, it's right behind the Lowe's Hardware, where the Lowe's Hardware store used to be on Route 2 in Brooklyn, Maryland. And I only remember one thing from that meeting. I remember there was a young black guy in a meeting. He had on a red checkered shirt, and he said, today can be the worst day, right? It can all be uphill from here. And that gave me just like a little bit of hope, man, a little bit of hope to keep going and keep trucking. So I'm going to meetings, and I mean, screw 90 and 90, I'm going into 100 bajillion and 90, right? Like, I'm going from the noon meeting to the 5:30 meeting to the 8 p.m. meeting to the candlelight meeting to the blah, blah, blah. I'm going to meetings, and I'm smoking 5 packs of cigarettes a day, and I hate every single meeting I'm going to, and I hate every single person in the meetings. And that's the end of my talk. Have a good night, guys. I mean, you guys know that feeling, right? When you're coming around and you're going to meetings and people start sharing and everybody's so flippin' grateful for every flippin' thing. You know, I'm sitting there miserable and everyone's like, I'm so grateful there was a rainbow on the way to the meeting and I know that God must love me because there's a rainbow, right? And oh my God, the worst guy, you know, the guy's like, you know, I used to live under a bridge, but then I came to AA, and now I'm vice president of a bank, and like, oh man, I'm grateful for the coffee, and I'm grateful for the big book, and I'm grateful for, I was going to get grateful for an AK-47 if this crap didn't stop. So I'm going to meetings, and I'm hating it, but more importantly, what's happening is I'm thinking, whatever these guys in AA have, I don't have that, right? Because this alcoholism thing, it's a thing where you drink too much. Okay, I drink too much. You go to these A&A meetings. Well, I'm going to the A&A meetings. I'm going to a bajillion of them. And then you get super happy and super healthy and you don't have a care in the world. Well, I'm going to these A&A meetings. I'm not drinking and I'm miserable. So I must not have what these A&A people have. And I'll tell you what happened, man. But I don't want to drink. I desperately don't want to drink because I knew by that point that if I started up again, I wasn't going to be able to stop. So I'm going to these meetings and we're at this cookout at the Samaritan House in Annapolis, Maryland, and we're at this cookout and I hate everybody there, right? And this girl, she asks me if I want to leave the cookout with her, right? And if you look like me and a girl asks you if you want to do anything, the answer is yes, right? So we leave the cookout, we take off, and we go meet up with her friends, and they're drinking Bud Limes and they're taking pills, and I don't want to do it, but I'm watching them like a cat watches you eat a tuna fish sandwich, man. I'm just like, right? And I knew in that moment that if something didn't change really, really quickly, it was 4th of July time, so figure I was sober just about 30 days at that point. And I knew if something didn't change really, really quickly that this A&A thing wasn't going to work for me and I was going to be back out doing what I was doing, right? And I'm at the Saturday Night Young People's Meeting in Annapolis, Maryland, and this guy, Kelson B., is speaking from the podium, right? And I hated every single word he had to say. So if you're sitting here tonight feeling that way, much love, you're represented, all right? And he calls on his sponsor to share. His sponsor was this guy, Scott, and Scott shared something, and I'm sure it was a wonderful share, but what I remember from his share was he had a motorcycle and a girlfriend, and I was like, that's the sponsor for me. I want what he's got, all right? I figure maybe if the motorcycle was old, he'd give it to me or something. I don't know, right? And so standard. So we go outside after the meeting, and I go up to him, like, hey, man, can I talk to you about something, man? Right, like, I felt like
can you sponsor me, man?
I felt like I was asking if I could be his girlfriend. Like, I mean, you know, arguably like the most humiliating moment of sobriety at this point, right? And he says, you know, sure, you know, let's go out to the restaurant after the meeting or whatever. And this guy who was the speaker, Kelson, comes up to me and he says, so what are you doing, man? And I said, man, I'm just trying not to drink and go to meetings. And he goes, you're probably going to die, bro. And like, I was really offended. I was ready to fight him outside the meeting. Like, again, I was young and tough back then. I'm fat and bald now. I got about 3 seconds of fighting before cardiac arrest in my life, you know. And And he's like, well, calm down there, Hoss, right? And what happens is these guys take me in the book. They take me in the book to the doctor's opinion where it says, in my opinion, one of the most important lines in our literature, it says he's restless, irritable, and discontent until he can once again gain the sense of ease and comfort that comes at once from taking a few drinks. See, my problem, the fact that once I start drinking, I can't stop drinking, that's a very small part of my problem. The much larger part of my problem is that once I stop drinking, it's like Clancy used to put it perfectly. It's like someone breaks into my house in the middle of the night and installs a spring in my gut. And that spring gets tighter and tighter and tighter and tighter. And then what happens, it tells us on page 52. Misery, depression, full of fear. Today we'd call that anxiety. Trouble making a living, trouble in personal relationships. What happens is that being sober is so miserable, is so painful, that against my own will, I will always return to drinking, right? I only ever had to drink that much because I didn't like how it felt when I didn't drink so desperately. Who here remembers the first time they had a drink, y'all? Anybody? I'm a big boy. I come up from Texas. I love barbecue brisket. If you gave me $1 million right now, I could not tell you the first time I had barbecue brisket. I can tell you exactly where I was the first time I drank, exactly who was in the room, what was on television, who I was with, because I'll tell you what, that first time I had enough alcohol in me to feel the effect, that voice in my head shut up. You know that voice in your head when you're laying there at 3 o'clock in the morning that says, remember that stupid thing you said in third grade? Everyone laughed at you, right? That voice, right? That voice shut up for the first time. That voice that says, oh, tomorrow, you're screwed tomorrow. It's all good. She's going to leave you tomorrow. The job's trying to fire you. It's all screwed tomorrow, right? I was up at a conference in Oklahoma last week with my sponsor, and this wonderful guy, Jimmy Dean gave the Friday night talk, and he said, I tell you what the drink did for me. He said, it made tomorrow 1 million miles away when I needed tomorrow to be 1 million miles away. And so what these guys do is they explain to me that my real problem is that I suffer from this spiritual malady, that once I start drinking, this thing inside me gets tighter and tighter and more uncomfortable, and I become more restless. And it never manifests itself as, well, gee, I've been sober a few weeks and I'm suffering the effects of a spiritual malady and I need a drink of alcohol to alleviate those effects, right? It comes out as, I just seem to notice all the stupid people in the world, right? And I notice how the guy in the 10-item line has 11 items because I've counted it 15 freaking times, and there will be justice at Safeway today. See all Safeways here? It's a grocery store. There will be justice at the grocery store today. And manifests says, you know what, I thought this was a good job, but these guys are all posers and losers. I got to get a different job. They're not treating me right. Right? It manifests says, you know what, I really thought Austin, Texas was a good city for me, but it's the wrong city. It's like, I got to get to a different city. This is a crap city, right? That's how it manifests. I start trying to arrange the things in the outside world to calm this feeling inside of me, but eventually I can't put anything between me, and nothing will calm the feeling inside me but a drink. And what these guys told me is that we were going to work the steps really, really quickly because I was really, really going to die. But if I worked these steps and I gave myself over to this process of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I would get to live sober and peaceful most of the time. And that was a really good promise. And I'll tell you the other thing they did with me, man. It says in our book, we pulled a new man with a vision, right? They dragged me around with them. They gave me my first service position in Alcoholics Anonymous. They made me the butt man, which I thought was going to be a great job until I found out it meant picking up cigarette butts in the parking lot after the meeting. I thought I was significantly overqualified for that. They didn't care. They took me, I remember it was like my second week with hanging out with those guys, so maybe I'm 5 weeks sober, and they were all going out to the beach, and they were going to stay at the beach and go swimming in the ocean and play football and go to meetings. And walk around on the boardwalk, and they're like, you're coming to the beach with us. I don't have any money for any kind of beach, you know. But those guys dragged me around with them, and they picked me up to take me to meetings, and they took me to the beach with them, and they bought me cigarettes and bought me cheeseburgers, and I've bought thousands and thousands of cheeseburgers trying to pay that back. If you've ever heard me talk before, you know that this is the point where I always mention that I told that story one time in Portland, Oregon, and a guy hollered out they could have bought you a salad once or twice. I think about that like way more than someone who does as much AA as I do should think about it. Like that resentment is still on some level still there. And I tell you what, man, it wasn't any more than maybe 6 weeks sober, and I had my first four step written and done, and I was going to do my first fifth step, and I'm sitting in my sponsor's house after the Friday night home group meeting, and we go do this fifth step, and I leave his house. It's probably 1-2 o'clock in the morning, and it's late summertime, it's thunderstorming, it hasn't started raining yet. And for the first time in my conscious memory, I didn't have the desire to drink. I didn't have the desire to use anything, right? That was a spiritual experience for me. Spiritual experiences, as I understand them, are a result of spiritual action. Alcoholics Anonymous is the process of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic just enough to reduce his feelings of separation so he can take actions that he doesn't yet believe in. It says, you see, I always want to be convinced that the actions will work, and then maybe if I like what you've said, then I'll go take the action, right? But that's not what these guys did, right? They qualified that they were like me. Not only did they drink like me, but they felt like me when they weren't drinking. And based on that, I was willing enough to take the actions that these guys had taken, even though I didn't understand or believe in them. I don't know anyone who has ever walked into Alcoholics Anonymous and looked at the steps on the wall and been like, admit my deepest, darkest secrets that my lawyer told me to never tell anyone, pay a bunch of useless pukes back a bunch of money. Awesome, sign me up for one AA membership, please, right? Like, I don't know anyone who's ever had that experience. Also, anybody else, when you came to a 12-step program to stop drinking, you thought that we'd quit sometime around step 11, right? Like, seems a little hasty to quit before one. I mean, just my opinion. You know, it wasn't but 2 weeks after I'd done that first inventory that I was out making amends, and the first amends I owed was to this hardware store that I'd worked at, and they paid me minimum wage, which is, I don't know, $5 an hour, and that was very offensive to someone as brilliant as me. I was like, how dare you? You don't understand what you have here, right? And so I was stealing from them and stuff, and I'm sitting in the parking lot of this meeting going, and I'm terrified to make this amends, right? Like, what if they call the police on me, you know? I've always found it funny, or recently found it funny, I guess, that when we're out there doing our thing, like, the thought of getting arrested doesn't really bother us that much. In fact, we're kind of brag on it, right? Like, yeah, baby girl, I'm an outlaw, you know, right? The minute we get sober, it's like, I couldn't possibly go to jail. That would be terrifying, right? So I call my sponsor from the parking lot of this hardware store, and I'm like, I don't know if I can do this, man. They might call the police. And he says, well, do you want to make the amends or do you want to drink vodka? And these guys, and had I been honest, I would have been like, drink vodka. Simple, right? But these guys had given me what I think the most important thing that I can give to a sponsee is they'd given me a fatal dose of the first step. I absolutely understood that if I started drinking again, I was not going to be able to stop, and that this process of Alcoholics Anonymous was the only chance I had at not drinking again. So I go in there and I make the amends, and it was a small store. I asked for the owner, and I'm like, I worked for you from this day to this day, and I stole this much stuff, and here's some money. And the dude was so confused, right? He, like, takes the money, and he, like, looks at me, looks at the money, and he's like, do you want, like, a receipt, or, like, and, like, I just booked it out of there. You know, nope, I'm good, thank you, and I booked it out of there before he had the time to change his mind, and I got in my car, and I take off, and drive it in that car away from there. God might as well have been next to me in the front seat, right? I had another spiritual experience as a result of spiritual action. Because the thing is, guys, is that the solution to alcoholism is not in meetings, right? I love meetings. I go to probably 7-8 meetings a week. I go to meetings. I go to meetings to be reminded to keep moving forward, to keep moving. I love the name of your group. Keep moving my feet forward first, right? That the solution is in the action. I go to meetings to find other people to help take them through the action. I go to meetings to find people to help take me through the action. I go to meetings because I need a fellowship of people who understand me and understand the common solution that I have to live. But the solution is not in meetings. The solution is in the actions. Meetings are a pep rally for God. Meetings are a pep rally for the steps that we do here to be sober. I don't know what I was talking about. Was it any good? I don't know. I got off on one. So I'm making these amends, man, and then, you know, I shortly thereafter I start sponsoring guys, man, and I'm driving from frickin' the mission up in Baltimore all the way down to Calvert County in this crappy little pickup truck with no brakes on it. Me and Magnesi did the brake job on it, you know. And for the first time, you know, my first grand sponsor used to say you gain self-esteem by doing esteemable things, right? We gave away our dignity and our integrity, $5 and $10 and $20 at a time, and we're going to buy it back the same way. And I bought back that dignity and integrity through the amends process and through the process of loving other people who came in here as broke, busted, disgusted, and not to be trusted as I was, man. And deep in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll share this. I sometimes share this part of my story. Sometimes I don't. So I was about 6 years sober, and I'm living in AA, man. I'm having an awesome time, and I'm chair of the young people's group, and I'm chair of the young people's bid, and I'm the GSR, I'm the inner group, I'm the ABC, and I'm the LMNOP, right? And I've got all this, and I'm doing all this AA, but my life is continually falling apart around me, and I don't understand why, right? And it's right around this time that I meet this guy Charlie Parker down in Austin, Texas, and asked him to sponsor me. And Charlie was big on page 60 to 63 in our book, and we start to talk about selfishness and self-centeredness. And see, the problem is when I hear selfish and self-centered, I think about like loud guys who wear a bunch of gold jewelry. Crap. right? What the very next line in our book, what it says is, whatever our protestations are, not most of us concerned with ourselves, our resentments, and our self-pity. See, it's not talking about thinking too much of myself, and it's not talking about thinking too little of myself. What it's talking about is all I think about is myself. The minute I have never once in 13 years of sobriety woken up in the morning and been like, I wonder how Andy's doing this morning. I got to check in on him, right? My first thought is always about my relationships, my kids, my money, my business, my right. It is the obsession of self. And then it says in the next line, the manifestations of this are our fears, our resentments, our self-delusion, and our self-pity. Right? Alcoholism, the ism, right? That feeling inside of me when I'm not drinking, the pain, the spring in my gut, it's caused. You guys see that Alien versus Predator movie, right? With the things on his face, right? It's like I've got me on me like this, right? And me thinking about me constantly produces nothing but sheer horror, right? And eventually, if I live like that long enough, I have to take a drink to alleviate those feelings. So I go to this guy Charlie, and we were down in Jacksonville, Florida, at an AA conference. And I'm telling this guy, I'm saying, I don't get what's going on, man. Like I'm all about AA, I'm all about service in AA, and my life is collapsing. I've got this girl pregnant over here, again continuing my distributorship, my distributorship of small Irish Catholics, and I've got this over here, and I'm making good money at this job, but I'm broke every month. My credit card's constantly maxed out. I'm living paycheck to paycheck. I don't get what's going on. And his wife Katie says to me, she says, Rory, how much of your day do you give to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I say, well I'm Mr. AA, if you didn't hear, I'm GSR, inner group, ABC, and LMNOP. And she says, no, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. She says, how many questions are there in the 11th step in the book, right? And I guessed, and I said 12, because 12 is normally the right answer around here, right? It isn't 12. She says, what are the 5 instructions in the 5th step? And I guessed, and I was like, don't drink, go to meetings, talk to another alcoholic. And she's like, you kind of got 1 of 5, right? And so I've been sober 6 years at this point, and I'd never, ever even looked at this part of the book. It's like I thought they put it in there last night, right? So what happens is I have all these external circumstances in my life that if you were watching my life from the outside, if you were watching the externality of my life, you would say, man, Rory's in some trouble. Right, because I get fired from this job that I was making this good money at, because I have to go back to Las Vegas to fight for custody of this kid, and all my money is going into this custody battle, so I can't afford an apartment. I leave this nice apartment in Austin, Texas. I can't afford an apartment. I'm staying with a buddy of mine. Right, so the best job I've ever had is gone. Right, the apartment is gone. I've moved back for this kid that I'm not seeing. The external circumstances of my life are falling apart. Right. But if you watched my feet, I was deep in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was deep in the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was fulfilling that third step contract. In our book on page 63, it gives us the third step contract. But the third step contract says, like any contract, there's two parts, right? There's the labor and then there's the pay. And the labor of the contract is I have to keep close to God through the process of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the pay, and perform his work well. Performing his work well is helping other drunks has to be the center of my life, has to be the number one focus of my life. But the payoff of it is that God will provide everything I need if I'm willing to accept that contract, right? And what happened at 6 years sober is I became willing on a different level to accept that contract than I'd ever been before. So what happened as a result of getting fired from that job is I started a business which gave me more wealth and financial security than I've ever had in my life. What happened as a result of going back and doing that custody thing is I now have sole custody of that child today, and he's down at my father's house in Maryland right now. And I got to have a better life than I'd ever had before through taking the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous in one of the most terrifying parts of my life. See, had you asked me how I was doing in that time, I would have said I'm doing terrible. The money's screwed up. I just lost the best job I ever had. I can't afford an apartment. Had you asked my sponsor how I was doing, he would have said, oh, Rory's doing great. He's doing more 11-step than he's ever done. He's doing more 10-step than he's ever done. He's making more amends than he's ever made. It's the difference between trust and faith, right? If I go to the circus and I look up at the high wire and I see the acrobat pushing the wheelbarrow across the high wire, I can have faith that he's going to be able to make it across the high wire, right? He's probably specially trained. He probably does a lot of exercises to work on his balance. He probably knows the perfect sequence of steps to take to make it across that high wire pushing the wheelbarrow. But if I trust he'll make it across the high wire with the wheelbarrow, I'll go up and sit in the wheelbarrow while he pushes it. Alcoholics Anonymous asks me to go sit in the wheelbarrow before I trust, to take actions that I do not yet believe in based on this third step contract. Right? So as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, my life gets really, really good. Right? That company that I started, I don't say this out of ego, hopefully you'll follow why I'm saying this in a minute. That company that I started ended up on the Inc. magazine list of 5,000 fastest growing businesses in America twice. I made several million dollars. I bought my dream house down in Texas, bought a couple of trucks, gotten a relationship and all that sort of stuff, right? And everything in chapter 5, it talks about, is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness from life if only he manages well, right? And victim at that time meant tricked or duped. I'm tricked into believing that I can be satisfied and happy if only I arrange the world to suit me, right? If only I have the perfect relationship and the perfect amount of money and the perfect circumstances. So here's what happened. I found myself with 12 years of sobriety, with several million dollars in the bank, in my dream house, sitting in the closet with a shotgun in my mouth crying. Alcoholism demands treatment, and it will be treated one way or another, through a drink, through suicide. It tells us in our book, many men make the ultimate sacrifice rather than to continue the fight. It will be treated one way or another, through a drink, through taking my own life, or through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's another line in our book that says, the persistence of this illusion is so astonishing, many pursue it to the gates of insanity or even death. And it's actually talking about the illusion that I can drink like other people, but the persistence of my illusion that I could just be happy if I arrange the outside world well enough is something I almost pursued into the gates of death. Sitting there with the little trophies about how wonderful my business had done, with a gun in my mouth crying, that's a level of first step experience that I don't wish on anybody. But that's a level of first step experience saying you can remove me from alcohol for an extended period of time and you can give me all the things that I think will make Rory happy, but alcoholism doesn't bow to anyone. That guy that I talked about at the beginning who was given the podium talk that night I got my first sponsor, he took his own life after having 7 years of sobriety. This disease, it makes no distinction about how much money we have, about where we come from. We got in the room tonight, we got men, women, we got black, white, we might have gay, straight, we got people from here, people from the south, we got people all over. You know, we got some beautiful people and we got some butt ugly people. I don't know, you know. I'm in the butt ugly camp, that's okay, right? I heard a speaker do that over the weekend. I figured I'd give it a shot, see if they rush the podium or not. And I am a recovered alcoholic, which means I've recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. I have not had the mental obsession to have a drink in a while. But I am always recovering from the disease of alcoholism, because if I take my foot off the gas, having alcoholism is kind of like having cancer. You don't have to consent to let cancer kill you, right? If you have cancer, you don't have to agree to let cancer kill you. If you don't show up for your chemotherapy, if you don't seek your treatment, it will kill your ass, just like alcoholism. Relapse is not an accident. Relapse isn't, I walked down the street one day and they had a great sale on beer, so, well, hell, I don't want to lose money on this deal, right? It's not a bad, I've only ever met people who relapsed for one reason. They went backwards because they were afraid of continuing to go forwards. It tells us in our book, what we really have is a daily reprieve based on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. If I neglect my spiritual condition long enough, that voice in my head that says you're a worthless abscess on the face of the earth will come back. Mark Houston used to say, people don't shoot themselves in the foot, they shoot themselves in the head, because that's where the voices are coming from. That restlessness, irritability, and discontentedness, the symptoms on page 52 will come back in my life. But what I've found is that in we agnostics, it tells us deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It's obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things. What I've found is that if I am willing to access the power of God through the process of Alcoholics Anonymous, that power of God is so much more powerful than that uncomfortability inside of me, that head that won't stop running. Alcoholics Anonymous is not an addition process, it's a subtraction process. We're subtracting the things that stand between me and the relationship with the loving God. A doctor doesn't heal anything. A doctor creates an antiseptic environment in which healing can take place. A farmer doesn't grow anything. A farmer tills the soil and creates a nutrient-rich environment in which growth can take place. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we're not healing anything. We are removing the things that stand between me and my Creator so my Creator can heal me internally. Alcoholics Anonymous is the absolute center of my life today. I'm very fortunate that you know, from time to time I get asked to do talks like this in AA, and sometimes there's even more than 10 people there, so that's nice too. But I'll tell you what my AA program is. If you come down to Austin, Texas one night, you go over to the Westlake Club, you'll find me there about a half an hour before the meeting starts with a pack of cigarettes, looking for a guy who's standing by himself and nobody's talking to him. A guy who might need a ride to get it, and might need a cheeseburger at McDonald's, and we can talk a little bit about the Big Book, and we can talk a little bit about alcoholism. I am an everyday member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because every time I try to walk away from Alcoholics Anonymous, I end up in a really, really bad state. And it's never once like I've stood, when I went through that 3-year period of untreated alcoholism that almost ended up in suicide, I never stood up and said, I'm done with AA. I never stood up and said, I'm leaving AA. What happened is, little by slowly, this one business deal became more important than going to that meeting. And this one date with the girl became more important than that service commitment. And this one external situation became more important than picking up that newcomer and taking him to the meeting. See, I'm a sick alcoholic, man. I live in Alcoholics Anonymous and I visit the world, and as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous being the most important thing in my life, man, I have my dream life. And the crazy thing is that nothing in my life has changed from that time I was in the closet with the gun in my mouth. I'm in the same business. I have less money than I had then. I'm in the same relationship. All the externals in my life are the same, but I have a level of peace and freedom in my life today that I've never had before. I'm starting to work with the idea. I'm starting to work with the idea that the longer we stay sober, we don't actually get any better. We just become more and more surrendered to the process. I say the third step in the 7-step prayer on my knees every single morning. And I didn't do that for most of my sobriety. And I don't really think God cares if I'm on my knees or if I'm driving in the car. But it puts me in the position to be surrendered. It puts me in the position to accept the will of God in my life and see that as my primary purpose, to carry that will out. You ever hear these old timers talk about how, you know, I used to call my sponsor and it cost me a quarter every time I made the call. Y'all ever heard that, right? So I was talking to my sponsor about this business deal that my company made a huge error in, right? And the customer didn't even know about it. And it was a $36,000 deal, right? And my sponsor, and I called my sponsor and I was like, Bob, I'm struggling financially. I need the money. And he goes, you got to pay back all the money, every cent. You got to tell them what happened. You got to send it all back to them. So, and it's like, clearly this man doesn't understand how money works, but, you know, okay, right? You know, Bob, I can't call the dang mortgage company and be like, I'm about a spiritual manner of living today, right? But the most common words I say to my sponsor, yes, sir. And I say, okay, right? So I type up the email and I tell them what happened and I send them back all the money. And walking out of my office, I had a greater feeling of freedom and peace than I'd ever had before. It's like a hot air balloon, right? When a hot air balloon rises, they cut off the sandbags to allow it to lift up a little more and lift up a little more. The amends process is the process of removing a little bit more and a little bit more that stands in between me and my Creator. When I was 2 years sober, I was stealing data from this company that I worked for, and you know, there had been a partner at the company who had gotten fired, and he called me and he said, hey, you know, they fired me. You know, I'm going to give you the passwords to the database. You go in and download all the data. We'll go sell it to their competitors. And I would have liked to tell you that at some point, when he said that, I thought about AA or spiritual principles. I was like, that sounds awesome. Let's do it, right? So I steal this data. I drove to Delaware, Kinko's, from DC to Delaware in the middle of the night, paid it at Kinko's in cash, downloaded this data, and sold it to their competitors. And around 4 years sober, I absolutely knew that I was going to drink again if I didn't make that amends. And it was a scary amends. I went into their office and I said, I asked them to talk to the owner of the company, and they met with me and I told them exactly what I'd done. And I said, I will pay you whatever you tell me this is worth. I can pay you $500 today and I'll pay you as long as you tell me to pay you. And if that's not enough for you and you want to press charges, I'll plead guilty. And it's a federal crime. And that wasn't one of those amends where they said, just stay sober, Rory, we're glad you're in AA, right? They said, we want you to put this all in writing and we want to give it to our lawyer, then we're going to decide what to do. That is a butthole buggering moment right there, right? Put it all in writing so we can give it to our lawyer, oh my God. So I do, right? I put it in writing and I give it to him and I'm waiting. Tomorrow's going to be the day that where it screws up, right? And nothing happens, right? Nothing happens, and I stay sober, and I build this business, I'm in the same industry I was then, so I see him at industry events once every couple of years or so. And I was about 3 months ago, I was driving back from West Texas back to Austin. It's a big drive; it's about 5 hours. And the guy who owns that company calls me. You got to understand, this is 9 years later, right? This guy calls me, and I'm like, that's weird. What's he calling for? So I answer the phone and, hey, Kurt, how are you, man? And we talk for a little bit and talk about my business and his business. He says, what would you think about you selling your business to us and coming over here and being vice president of our company? You see, I don't know when I make the amends that God's going to do stuff like that, right? If God would give me a peek behind the curtain, if God would say, Rory, we got to get you out of this, we got to get you up involved in this kid's life and out of this relationship because his mother is going to relapse and you're going to get sole custody. If God would say, Rory, we got to get you out of this job, you know, and get you over here because you're going to start your own business and you're going to have a level of financial security for you and your family that you've never even dreamed, I would say, absolutely, God, I'm on board, but that's not how God works. God provides me with these golden steps and these actions, and if I'm willing to take these actions, then God, in my experience, has never let down his end of the contract. God has never, ever not provided for me what I needed. And the problem is sometimes I don't like what it is God's providing, but if I'm willing to take the actions of a man who believes, even if I don't believe, then I've never, ever seen it fail. Clancy used to talk about the invisible boat, and I think that's a beautiful analogy for what we're doing here, right? It's like we're drowning in this water, and we can't get above water, and we're paddling as hard as we can, but we just can't get our heads above water. And and the SS Treatment Center pulls up, right? This big, beautiful boat, the SS Treatment Center, and on the Treatment Center boat, they've got chefs and therapists and, you know, and maybe it's a nice one, and they've got equine, they've got horses that you can pet, and, you know, all this kind of crap, right? You know, crafts you can do, and girls with the grippy socks, and, you know, the whole thing, right? And next to that boat pulls up another boat. It's an invisible boat, and there's two, you know, goobers on the boat paddling above the water, and they say, "We're from Alcoholics Anonymous. Would you like to get in our invisible boat?" And you're like, "No, I'm going up there with the girls and the food and the chefs and the therapy," right? And eventually you get thrown, you know, after 30 days or 60 days or 90 days or whatever, you get thrown off of that boat, and again, you're back in the water, and you're drowning, and you're struggling to breathe, and again, the guys in the invisible boat come and pull up, and they say, "We're from Alcoholics Anonymous, would you like to get in our invisible boat?" And again, you think it's crap, but you're like, "Sure, because I've got nothing else, because I got no other options," right? And they drag you and they pull you into the boat, right? And you say, "What do I do?" They say, "Grab an oar and start rowing." And as you row and as you row and as you row, the boat starts to appear around you. And eventually what you have is you have this wonderful, beautiful boat, and you're having a safe journey across the water with your fellows in Alcoholics Anonymous. But the problem is, if you put the oar down and you stop rowing, the boat starts to disappear. And once you fall back into the water, you say, "I guess that boat was never real in the first place. I go to meetings to be reminded to keep rowing the boat. I go to meetings to be reminded that rowing the boat is my primary purpose in life." I'm going to read one thing out of the book, then I'm going to shut up. Y'all know the two lies every speaker tells? "I'll be quick and I'll shut up with this," right? Those are the two lies every speaker tells. I told you I don't plan out what I'm going to say, so, you know, it's page 97. You know, what I love so much about this book, right, is it's a series of actions and promises that follow the actions if I take it, right? And on page 97, my buddy likes to call these the 12-step promises. It says, "Never avoid these responsibilities. Be sure you are doing the right thing if you assume them. Helping others is the foundation stone of your recovery. A kindly act once in a while isn't enough. You have to be the Good Samaritan every day if need be. It may mean the loss of many nights' sleep and great interference with your pleasures or your business. It may mean sharing your money in your home." Okay, there's a promise. I'm going to have money and I'm going to have a home. "Your telephone may jangle at all hours of the night. I'm going to have a telephone. Your wife may say she is neglected. You're going to have a wife. A drunk may smash the furniture in your home or burn your mattress. I'm going to have furniture, a home, and a mattress. That ain't a bad promise. My experience is that if I'm willing to make Alcoholics Anonymous the center of my life, that this light, this power, this God, whatever it is, will heal anything inside of me. And I get to have the most wonderful and peaceful life I've ever known." I drove up here with my fiance. She's down in Doylestown speaking at an Al-Anon meeting tonight. My other job is I'm a you know, national rep producing Al-Anons, you know. I'm waiting for them to give me an award for like most Al-Anons produced or something. They don't seem to be willing. This program is on offer for everyone, man. I heard a guy say one time, he said, "God's love is like the sun. If I walk outside on a sunny day, the sun doesn't say, 'No sunshine for you, Rory. I know what you've been doing.' The sun shines on me because that is what the sun does. That is the function of the sun. The sun's 93 million miles away, and it shined on all of us today. There is nothing I can do that is powerful enough to stop the sun from shining on me. There is nothing I can do that is powerful enough to stop God from loving me. But if I hide in the basement and I don't get any sunshine, that's not the sun's fault. Alcoholics Anonymous has shown me the way out of the basement, and I honestly feel it showed me the way out of the basement not once but twice. God loves you, we love you, and I love you. Thanks."
The group would like to thank Rory for sharing his experience.